This is CliffCentral.com.
All right, CliffCentral.com on a pretty damn good Thursday morning, despite a lot of news and political nonsense. But that's what we're here to do this morning. It's what we're here to do every Thursday morning on the Burning Platform. It's brought to you by Nando's. I'm thrilled to be joined again by Canthan Pillay. Pumi Mashiho is in the studio with us too. We're going to have a nice little discussion around all the important information in current affairs, in politics, in society, and occasionally also in the economy. So I'm happy to welcome Canthan back. First of all, you're looking very happy and healthy, full of the joys of spring.
I had an utterly fabulous French onion soup last night. It took me about 5 hours to cook in total because I've learned this amazing new method, which, you know, I'm happy to go into in your cooking segment later.
Of course,
on.
We will start a special cooking segment specially for Canthan.
Him and Uncle Tito.
Yeah, the two of you can compare recipes.
That's exactly right, yeah. By the way, before we start, I want to send a shout out to Musi Maimane. It's his 39th birthday.
Oh.
In 6 years' time, he'll be eligible for membership in the ANC Youth League.
Which is where he really wants to be. Deep down inside, that would make him happy. All right, a few things we want to talk about in the Burning Platform today. I would categorize this, according to Nando's menu of hotness, as being spicy to very hot. So here are a couple of things on the agenda, and if you have any ideas, you can always get hold of us. So the first thing is Cyril's gormless, shapeless economy and how that is not performing. Second thing we need to talk about is Ace's insistence on making us all poorer, which he seems hell-bent on doing. This crazy obsession with the Reserve Bank, which even the Minister of Finance thinks is ridiculous. If we cast our eyes further afield, Emmerson Mnangagwa under house arrest by the Zim military, that's the rumor we're hearing from across the border. Are the Proteas and their uselessness a threat to national unity? Something that Pumi and Canthan and I feel strongly about. And which cabinet minister, this is a serious question, which cabinet minister would you want as head of your household if you had to choose at gunpoint?
Yeah.
I assume that I'm at gunpoint and the minister is not at gunpoint.
No, you're at gunpoint because if the minister's at gunpoint, he's gone. Or she. And the inevitable, what is happening with the ZACP since the elections? We haven't had an update from Canthan, so we'll get to that at the end too. So loads of things on the agenda. Shall we start off with President Cupcake, as Pumi calls him, Cupcake, as Canthan calls him, Cyril.
His Excellency.
We thought Cyril had a mandate now that he's president. He had a big inauguration where parabats fell all over the place on Loftus's main field. We continue to see poor results coming out of the economic data that we released this week. How are we feeling about Cyril? Any change since the last time we convened, comrades?
So this morning, very early, I woke up to a a tweet from Chyna N.
Yes.
And she said, the day I locate the podcast where you shared about Cyril not being a man of decisions or actions, I will post it. You called it hands down.
Okay, we'll take that. Thank you very much.
I was like, yeah, Chyna. Chyna, I was... Right. Her handle says Chili, but with the T-Y, like in Xhosa.
Chili. Okay, well, thank you very much. So again, we can claim credit for being a little bit better than the average political analyst, and there's so many of them, who knows where to start. Canthan, what do you reckon?
You notice how quickly we've forgotten about the contraction in the economy simply because of the fact that Ace drops this bombshell after that.
We have not forgotten.
Yes.
We have not forgotten. We feel it every damn day.
Yes, we're totally distracted from it now.
Never.
There's something really perverse about a government that on a day where petrol goes up again and where we have all this bad news on the economy and we're really on the brink with one of the ratings agencies, the others have already given up on us, that Ace Magashule has so little regard for the well-being of the people of this country that he is prepared to put his own political games ahead of the health of our economy. He doesn't care at all. Ace Magashule does not care at all. Am I right? There's no other way to...
Assuming you have sufficient money, which, you know, certain people sitting in certain countries in the Arabian sector, as an example,
You mean the Guptas?
Yeah, that's it. I was trying to remember what their name, you know, short attention span and all that.
Yeah.
On the assumption that you've got access to sufficient cash, you know, you can actually short the rand, wait for a politically connected person such as Ace to drop a significant bombshell, tank the rand, and pick up significant profits.
So it's as cynical as that. They're playing with our currency.
Well, what does Ace know about the economy otherwise?
Well, nothing.
What reason would he possibly have? Because I'm pretty sure that conversations have taken place within the ANC to say that, guys, be very careful in terms of statements that you issue around the economy because they're likely to have consequences. But, you know, if I was sitting in Ace's position and if I was corrupt, I would very definitely be playing those cards. Now, it's possible that Ace is not corrupt. He's merely stupid. But, you know, we need to flip a coin.
Either way, it's the most cynical thing in the world. If he's doing it on instruction or on a whim or because he's been promised reward, or if he just doesn't care, it's very destructive, right?
Well, he's not going to be president. Well,
no.
Not in the short term at any rate.
No, so maybe this is...
Didi has got that...
this is the only card he can play, is what you're saying.
No, I'm saying that right now there's still... The Guptas are definitely still pushing every single opportunity to exploit the possibility for profit from this country because they've put in place this really fabulous infrastructure, which was state capture. So they've got Gupta deployees in every single department in the entire country and who no doubt are still doing important things in terms of... assuring that tenders go to the right people, all of that kind of stuff, and sowing mayhem along the way. I mean, ask yourself, who is responsible for burning these trucks on the N3, and why is no one able to stop them?
Or the trains in only one province, the Western Cape. Why is it that the trains, or every train that ever
we don't
burns,
care what happens in another country.
All right, tell me quickly, Ace's statement was, he briefed the media Tuesday afternoon and said the following. The Lekgotla agreed that unemployment is now going to be a national emergency. We're declaring unemployment a national disaster. This is what these people get together and discuss. And they think their words are going to magically make things change. So what is the obvious response to this? What are you going to do about it? Because government can't make jobs. If unemployment is a disaster, the first thing you need to do is start repairing the economy and to step out of the way. Do you think either of those things are going to happen?
No, they're not.
Okay, they're moving right along.
All right. Well, I mean, listen, I'm trying to find a...
Canton, we have 50 minutes to go.
Guys, if you're looking for Ramaphosa, you know, should have...
No, we're not going to find it.
You should have Peter Bruce on the show, or you should have Justice Malala on the show.
We won't do that. Yeah. They've got plenty of runway in already discredited publications. Let's leave it at that.
Yes.
I'm not prepared for us to sink ourselves into that pigsty either. okay, what is this dumb obsession with the Reserve Bank? Pumi, do you know what it is? Canton, do you have any suggestions?
You know, so I'm trying to find the resolution that was circulated. Canton, you're on these WhatsApp groups. There was that resolution from Nasrec about the Reserve Bank, and I'm trying to find the words that were used, which I thought, what does that even mean? One of the things.
There are supposedly private shareholders in the Reserve Bank. Now, anyone can buy a share in the Reserve Bank.
Mm-hmm. Correct. And in fact, the current governor, Khaniako, extended the mandate of the Reserve Bank to, well, not the mandate, but the shareholding structures, so that he could actually increase the number of private shareholders. And the idea was to actually open it up to the masses, so to speak. So I forget what the actual amount was, but for a relatively small amount of money, you could actually end up buying shares in the South African Reserve Bank.
So instead of all of us just buying a share in the Reserve Bank, which would be the way to at least, and I mean, this is all very symbolic because actually you don't go to shareholders meetings or any of that stuff. It is partly a state-controlled mechanism, and they only have one lever with which to make any moves on the economy, and that is interest rates. It's clear and it's easy to see, and it's evident to everybody that the governor of the Reserve Bank is appointed by the politicians mostly by the president, who's already in control of this machine. I don't know why the ANC are currently showing them. They love to be victims.
All right.
The ANC
okay,
loves so, to okay, imagine so you, that there's so, a world so, that's manipulating them.
All right.
They need someone to rail against, because if they don't, they have to accept the fact that they are responsible for the disaster they've brought themselves to.
All right. So let me give you guys the economy lecture in terms of how this thing actually works and what the big picture is that they're trying to push for. Right now, we have this thing called the interest rate, okay, which everyone talks about. So so once a month, the Monetary Policy Committee meets and they make an announcement.
Four times a year.
Yeah, well, whatever. But, in terms of, whether the interest rates are going to be pushed up or whatever. But fundamentally, what happens is that interest rate is the rate at which the Reserve Bank lends money to the commercial banks.
Right.
Okay. So the commercial banks themselves actually don't have access to massive tranches of money, because the commercial banks operate by lending out other people's money and earning interest from it. And that's the way in which banks make money. So let's say you have a scenario where Standard Bank suddenly needs to be funding a massive project, construction project of a shopping mall somewhere in rural KZN, as an example.
Mm-hmm.
And they need a dramatic injection of cash. What they have to do is they go to the Reserve Bank, and the Reserve Bank then makes that money available to Standard Bank at the prevailing interest rate. And Standard Bank, in turn, lends that out to their customers at a high interest rate, and that's how the bank makes the money. But ultimately, the money supply goes back to the Reserve Bank.
Mm-hmm.
But the conditions under which the Reserve Bank is able to release money to the commercial banks is under the control of the shareholders of the Reserve Bank, because obviously they have to play by the rules. If you remove the oversight mechanism that comes from the private shareholders, a situation like a VBS, where you can suddenly transfer massive tranches of money into a bank that is then designated by the ANC as a proper commercial bank, and suddenly the bank goes under and gets completely looted, it is the path to theft.
It's a path to Zimbabwe.
No, it's a path to theft. You see, Zimbabwe, the situation, yeah. The Zimbabwe
situation.
They
started situation, printing money for this.
No, you see, it's not printing money, it's stealing money. We can't have the printing money scenario, because the constitutional mandate of the Reserve Bank is to defend the currency against inflation.
Okay.
So we can't randomly increase the money supply, which is, by the way, is what quantitative easing is all about. But we can't do that simply because that's a constitutional mandate. However, if you have a scenario where suddenly there's a black-owned bank, as people keep pushing the agenda, consider that the biggest shareholders in the commercial banks right now is the PIC. But let's put that aside. If you have a scenario where you suddenly have an ANC-endorsed bank that gets granted a banking license, and suddenly you have money that then flows from the Reserve Bank into these private banks and then gets diverted into the pockets of random other people. So by removing the oversight mechanism that comes from the private shareholders, we would raise a hand and say, hang on a second, okay, these guys are dodgy. You shouldn't be releasing this money to them. So it's all about capture.
Which, bravo to Lesetsha Kanyako for, very quickly saying, getting out there, getting in front of it to say, listen, we don't have provisions for quantitative easing.
But that's not quantitative easing. You see, so the quantitative easing thing is not going to happen. That's a smokescreen.
Okay.
I'm saying that the end goal is theft.
And this is
a mechanism for theft.
All right. So then this is the real story that's going on. This is why the ANC is suddenly toing and froing about Reserve Bank shareholding.
Well, I'm saying that understand the faction that actually pushed the agenda around removing the private shareholders. You're removing oversight. That's what you're doing.
All right. You want to
Saying it's a smoke and screen. So it's smoke and mirrors, this kind of now we're talking this, look over here and we're not going to talk about this massive, 3.2% down in one quarter in our, GDP is a wipeout. And are you saying nobody's having that conversation anymore? And that's why
But you need to understand this, that we had everyone, I think most economists had predicted that we would have a contraction during the first quarter, and the contraction that was predicted was on average about 1.7%. Okay, that was already priced into the market, and was a lot of it was tied to the fact that Eskom was an absolute disaster during the first quarter. You remember, we suddenly had rolling blackouts once again.
And where have they gone?
And that 1.7% was then priced into the economy. But no. Correspondingly, during the first quarter, government expenditure increased over and above budget by, it was a fairly significant percentage. I think it was almost 2%.
Why? We were delivering combi cots. What's wrong with you?
Yeah. But essentially, when you have unbudgeted expenditure on top of
contraction,
yeah, now you understand why the economy is tanking. We have an undisciplined bunch of palookas who are actually running government, and no one is calling them to order.
It's jarring. I have to be honest.
Garrison.
I don't know how to explain this one to myself. I'm struggling to see how this can be addressed in a meaningful way, other than to call them what you just have and to say there's a problem. This president has a real task on his hands in order to stabilize the country and grow the economy. And
but you work on the assumption the president is capable of doing so. I mean, who are these two guys that he's appointed in terms of trade and industry and economic development? They're both communists.
Yes.
How do you fix a capitalist economy, which is what we need to be in order to grow, by putting communists in charge of it?
You can't.
So why are we even having this conversation?
All right, let's move on. Are the Proteas a threat to national unity?
Shame, man. We didn't even talk about their performance yesterday. How did they perform? I don't know what happened there yesterday.
Nobody's watching them, but are
you a cricket watcher, Canthan? Cricket watcher, cricket lover?
I have this slogan on my T-shirt, okay, which says, do I look like an effing team player?
No, but this is, all right, so I'm not a big sports fan either. In fact, I've never cared about sport at all. But I know lots of people in this country attach their daily happiness to how well a team that they love is doing or how poorly. And their mood is entirely affected by that, for good or for bad. I'm not going to judge them. But I do find that there is absolutely no reason for us, where sport was at least a pressure valve for some people. It was an ability to feel like everything was not about the losers around them. Losers. This country is filled at the moment with a hopeless bunch of losers in powerful positions. And our sports teams are filled with losers. And I see a load of people who are very angry with the Proteas at the moment. And I can't help thinking that they're projecting onto a fairly middle-of-the-road team, by all accounts, their feelings of South Africa falling behind the world. And I know this is a possibly stretched metaphor, but just for a minute consider that maybe South Africa is... We're going backwards at a rate of knots at the moment in terms of our position in the world and our place in the economy of the world. We don't have very much to contribute. A lot of our brilliant people and our best, our smartest people are leaving in their droves. We know about this. What remains is being pillaged by people who are clearly incompetent in making things better and in creating wealth and in growing an economy. They're only good at taking what there already is. And we have an unemployment rate, which Ace has said is now a national emergency. I think it was a national emergency a little while ago when we first started talking about it on this show.
So I don't know if it's a stretched analogy. I was actually thinking about the cricket going into yesterday morning, and I'm not a big cricket watcher myself. But I do remember hearing the interviews just as they were leaving, right? And to hear Faf go... Oh, Gareth, man, they are women with the size. You know, to hear Faf sound almost as much as that sigh of yours did. At interviews, going completely unmotivated, going, yeah, we're all going into
well,
this
we
thing.
Were only at 50,
how the
60%.
Hell?
This is what he going, said.
If we don't do well, it won't be my fault. I'm like, what the bloody hell? He should have been fired. How do you go into, as the leader of a team, with such a down spirit? Such a down spirit. There's no way that if you feel that way as the leader, you will ever be able to inspire even in
But they say the fish rots from the head, right? And we have a country where we've already seen countless people getting away with being less than average and still getting paid. So why would it be any different for our sports teams?
He was definitely, I was just like listening to that interview going, this guy, he should be fired simply for feeling the way that he does, going on an interview and feeling like that. Just as you remember last week, we were talking about KPIs and I was like, I wish I knew what the KPIs for the minister were. I felt the same way about him. I was like, I wish I knew what this guy's KPI is. What does it look like when he performs? If he's going to go into a World Cup on some, if we don't do well, it's not going to be my fault. Mm. Like what? It's damn straight. You are the main person that we're going to hold at fault. Is he going to get fired like the Bafana coaches get fired? That's what I want to know.
No, we always fire coaches. We never fire players.
I can't talk about the Proteas. I get all choked up.
All right. For a moment of comic relief, if you had to choose a minister as the head of your household, who would you choose? Remember, the gun is being held to your head.
To my head.
Tito. Definitely Tito.
Yeah, because you'll at least get stew at the end of each day.
Exactly. And Tito has a fondness for single malt whiskies, which I share.
Yes.
Yes.
Because Tito's a capitalist deep down inside.
Yes.
I know that no one likes to face up to this.
Worked for Goldman Sachs.
Yeah. And if there isn't a capitalist organization in the world like Goldman Sachs, there isn't an organization in the world.
Yes.
So, okay.
What's the duty of that head? What is it that the head of the household needs to do?
Well, they need to provide for the family. I think Tito could do that. They need to be...
After 5 hours, you'll at least have a chicken stew?
Yeah, but you'll have... there's a level of dignity and respect to this person. They're responsible. I mean, mostly he fits that bill. Are there any other ministers that you would even consider after last week's cabinet announcement? And the reason I ask this is, obviously we're having fun here, but it's not so funny, because actually I wouldn't hire any of these people to work for me. And yet our president has chosen 60-something people, including all the deputy ministers, of which there are a lot. He's chosen these people to be his cabinet, the first line through which he will get the bureaucracy working.
Here's the interesting thing. We actually don't need those deputy ministers.
None of course not.
And the reason why we don't is because every time a minister is out of the country, one of the other ministers then acts as the minister in that department.
Yeah, because...
So it's a complete waste of time.
Because they're not even... They can't be, because they're not even MPs.
That's like correct.
The deputy minister thing irritates me tremendously. So I don't want to talk about deputy ministering of any kind.
Do you want to talk about Busisiwe Mkhwebane? She said she's ready for attacks on her office. So she is standing prepared to be attacked, which tells you a lot about her current mental state. She announced on Monday she has served notice to Pravin Gordhan in relation to her investigation into the minister's meetings with the Gupta family and his alleged involvement in the so-called SARS rogue unit. What's making this interesting is that the EFF are suddenly the biggest fans of Busisiwe Mkhwebane, and she has this vendetta with Pravin, and he's taking her on. And the consequences of the fight between Pravin and Busisiwe could be very, very bad for one, will be very, very bad for one of them, right?
I can't possibly see how it's going to be bad for Pravin. I mean, every time he goes to court and he overturns all of her pinprick irritation. The courts have already established that he didn't act unprocedurally.
So, well, this is still over that that resignation. Sorry, that it was a payment that was made to someone who'd
well,
retired.
Well, essentially he allowed Ivan to take premature early retirement. But
and take his retirement payout.
Yeah, and take his retirement payout, but then kept him on under contract. This happens all the time in the private sector.
Doesn't sound illegal.
It isn't.
So why are they? Why is the public protector?
And more to the point, he was at the time he was minister. He was not the commissioner.
Okay, so he's allowed to.
Yeah, well, I mean, he basically, they're holding him accountable, not that he personally, authorized the transaction.
No, they're not going after the SARS commissioner.
Yes, exactly.
Which they should be doing. Yeah. So what is the real story here? This is obviously a bullshit ruse. So what's actually going on?
So one of the things that has been deeply fascinating for me to watch over quite a number of different spaces is this insistence of on having these fights out in the public domain. So, yeah, people, you know, people have these kinds of fights all the time, but they don't really have to happen in the public domain. But what?
Oh no, but they do. You see, the reason why they have to, because if you consider the timing in terms of how all of this stuff occurred, it was in the build up to the appointment of the cabinet.
Precisely.
And so suddenly there were two key players that were in doubt. The one was the deputy president, and the second was PG. And you ended up with the public protector coming out with this finding that was basically calling on the president to hold him accountable and essentially prevent him from appointing him to cabinet. At the same time, you had the ANC's Integrity Commission saying, actually, hang on a second, we need to have a look in terms of the people that you want to be appointing going forward now.
So,
and there was horse trading that took place behind the scenes, because I'm pretty sure that what finally happened was that within the ANC, it was like, okay, we'll allow you to get PG in on condition that that DD comes in as well.
But this is my point. This watching these people duke it out in the public domain is simply to manipulate all of us. It's to manipulate the public around all of these behind the scenes kind of machinations. And it's what's particularly fascinating for me is how that is also now beginning to spill over into the private sector, because we also have lots of political types everywhere in the private sector too. You know, when I think about what's happening at Old Mutual with Peter Moyo and having a fight with his chairman.
They're also making these things public.
And now it's become a public fight. Executives have, executives have differences with their boards all the time.
But they resolve them internally.
They resolve them internally. But our politicians are so used to manipulating public opinion in this manner. And the thing about it is it is so damaging. It's so damaging for our economy. It's so damaging for the psyche of the nation. And it's damaging to them too. Pravin may win all of his court cases, but because he insists on having these big public spats, it creates in the mind of the public.
I think it's fair to say that he didn't want this to be a big public spat.
No, I don't think that's fair to say.
I think it is. I think he's quietly defending himself. All of this has been brought by Busisiwe Mkhwebane. I mean, I thought this was resolved. I thought it had gone away. It was news a year and a half ago. It's still in the news. There's someone pushing. And why are the EFF so anti-Pravin? I need to understand that too. Does anyone have an idea?
I think it's deeply tied to VBS.
Do you think Pravin knows exactly what was done there?
No, I don't think so. But I do think that every attempt right now, and fascinating thing is that if you look, every time there's a new allegation that comes out around the EFF profiteering from the VBS scandal, that the EFF threatens to take people to court and...
But they haven't. So it's all hot air.
Yes.
Because you know what happens with people who go to court, right?
They get found guilty or not guilty and they get...
Yeah, people, you're either going to get vindicated. You're either going to get vindicated or
you
are not.
You might remember we had this discussion last year, you know, around the whole Polly van Wyk thing where, you know, she made accusations against the EFF, and the EFF said it's a bunch of lies. And her response, very accurately, is
take me to court
and make your bank statements available, which the EFF is not prepared to do. And I said at the time that, you know, what's very likely is that there is a whistleblower who has allowed her access to those bank statements, but, you know, clearly she cannot blow the
her whistleblower out of the water.
Exactly. But at the same time, she can't publish it because she knows that it's the truth. And all the EFF can do is say that it's a lie, but they will refuse to actually go through the process of subjecting it to judicial scrutiny.
You see, and so part of what the Polly van Wyk thing shows us is that media gets fed information also. You know, everybody's got their own sources. Everybody's in WhatsApp groups about something, and you know, everybody knows somebody that they can call to verify or dispute a thing. But there's a line at which that can be disclosed as to who that person is. And why I'm saying that it's not honestly fair to say that Pravin has quietly been trying to, you know, vindicate himself, is I think that he is very deft at using the media for his benefit to bring these things out to bring these out to the fore. Because, you know, if you're out here, nobody has to say that, well, I heard it from Pravin himself. All you just need to do is just talk about the things that you have heard on the outside. So when the public protector starts out her shenanigans, when she is sending out, all you need to do is you need to let somebody know that you're going to get a call from the public protector's office. And then, you know, so I'm not sure if it's fair to say that he is quietly out there defending himself. He's a media darling and he knows how to use the media.
All right, fair enough. I can find myself corrected. Okay. Former President Jacob Zuma says he might write a book.
He's been saying that for years.
Here's a comment from Michelle who says, he can't read. How's he going to write a book, Michelle? Bridget says, wow, Canton, I voted for your party. I don't like your comment about the Western Cape. It smacks of arrogance. So Bridget obviously lives in the Western Cape.
Yes, I would have voted for the Cape Party if I lived in Cape Town still.
And Mr. Schmangel says, regarding the Reserve Bank, I think the ANC politicians should stay away from anything that has the word bank at the end of the name, like Reserve Bank, River Bank, Blood Bank, Power Bank, and so on. These ANC politicians steal. They steal a lot. There's no two ways about it. Privatization of the state entities is probably the best way to go. Our economy went into a downward spiral under their watch. So that's Mr. Schmangels.
I don't think it's a matter of Jacob Zuma can't read. It's a matter of he doesn't read.
Yes.
So the function he knows how to do, it's just he just doesn't do it.
Guys, you know, frankly, I would love to see a book written by Jacob Zuma. And frankly, all he has to do, whatever you may say about Jacob Zuma, The man is a raconteur of note. He's an amazing storyteller. Get Jacob Zuma in front of a crowd. He's so engaging.
Yeah, he's so engaging.
And really all you need is for a biographer to sit down with a guy and just have him free flow those stories. I want to know about all of the stuff that happened before Jacob Zuma became, you know, the captured Jacob Zuma that we know of today. I mean, the guy... I remember at one stage researching just how many languages the guy speaks. He's quite a phenomenal linguist. I understand that he speaks Russian very well. He speaks French very well. Remember that this is the guy who negotiated the peace treaty in Burundi. I want to know what went on behind the scenes at the time that that this stuff was happening. So there are fascinating stories that are likely to come out of this. So this guy was on the ground in Angola when Quito Carnival was happening. I want to know what was happening at the time. You know, what was involved working with the Cubans, all of that. This is a critical part of our history, which, you know, shelve your dislike for the guy. Recognize that he's actually got really important stories to tell.
But I wish he'd tell all of them. This is what I was saying to Pumi earlier. Now he's got nothing to lose. And she said, I mean, Pums, I'm going to paraphrase you here, but you basically said his loyalty to the ANC is all he has, and he will never turn on the people in the ANC. But he knows something.
If he thinks that it will damage the party ANC, right, even further.
Yeah, except I think that our obsession with the internal machinations of the ANC is not the interesting stuff that he'd have
I
to
want
tell
to hear
us.
The interesting stuff. I want to hear the scandals.
Yes,
except
we're not going to hear the stuff that he was doing as ANC intelligence head while he was in exile. We're not going to hear about the disappearances of ANC people. That's not going to come out. But what I'm saying is that there are stories that will actually make for good storytelling that we need to know about in terms of the
and the disappearances of the certain sons of certain people.
A former news editor of mine was fond of saying, when legend becomes fact, you print the legend, not the fact.
Hmm. All right, well, the foundation said citizens are invited to submit photographs and articles about their interaction with the president, the former president. You may have met him when he was a herd boy or a young worker or a trade unionist or on Robben Island or in Mkhonto weSizwe as an underground operative or even when he was head of ANC intelligence, the foundation said in a statement. Perhaps you have interacted with him when he was part of CODESA, served as MEC of KZN, or you may have known him when he was deputy president and then president of South Africa. The foundation said submissions for the book could be sent to admin@jacobzumafoundation.org.za.
Do you have a story of meeting the man?
I have met the man.
Tell us your story, Kevin.
There's nothing significant to be told. He came over a couple of times when I was running YFM, and you know, we had him on our current affairs shows. And as I said, you know, he's what was kind of interesting was that he was deputy president of the ANC at the time, but he was not deputy president of the country because he'd been bounced by
Thabo.
By Thabo. And
he was running. Kind of, what was his big job that he had when he was the deputy president of
the moral regeneration? The moral movement.
Regeneration.
Yeah, but again, guys, you know, let's not get distracted because we're talking about. We had Malema on a couple of weeks prior to him, and Malema was questioned about his education levels because remember at the time Malema had not actually gone through the process of becoming the educated person that he is today. And Malema got very defensive about the fact that he had not had tertiary education at that point and said it's absolutely unnecessary for a person to have tertiary education. And the YFM audience then piled into him because they said, no, this is absolute rubbish. Then a few weeks later, you had Jacob Zuma coming on air and he was asked, but you know, is it true that you didn't complete high school? And Jacob Zuma turned around and he said, no, in fact, my highest level of education was standard 3. But just a message to people out there, the most important thing that you can do is to actually get yourself educated. And people love that. You know, the fact that, you know, he was up front saying, I'm uneducated, but don't use that as a role model. Hmm. As I said, the guy knows how to actually speak to his particular audience and get them on his side.
And you, Pumi, have you had interactions with him that were interesting?
I refused to take a picture with him, though.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
No, why?
There's a picture of me with him.
This is not one of the things I want to document. Even at the time, I said, no, I don't want a picture of this one. I have pictures with Mandela. I have pictures with Mbeki. I've got a picture of Nkuluwa as well.
Oh.
So tell me about yours, Pum.
So it's a long story, but I will tell you this. One of the people that taught Jacob Zuma on Robben Island is a PAC cadre, Mark Shinas, who was at Robben Island for 22 years in total. And he had a very fascinating story to tell about the love for learning that Jacob Zuma had. Now, understanding that this guy came, and part of the reason why he only had up to standard 3 and then became a herd boy was really because they were so dirt poor. They were so poor. And I think his father had had a second wife. So he was istembu. He was and then his dad died. And this is part of the story of my short interaction with him, was him telling the story of how his older brother, who used to work at the Joko factory in Durban, is also one of the people that told him about, so formal education may not be available to you, but it's important that you never stop learning. You never stop asking questions. You never stop giving yourself the opportunity to be better than what you are. And the man is incredible. I mean, we see him on TV and he's charismatic and he's all of those things. But in front of you, he is 1,000 megawatts of just charm.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one of the things that always tickles the cockles of my Zulu heart is a man who speaks the Zulu language with such command. And where he's from, Nkandla, is very close to where my father's from and where my father grew up. So he has the same use of language as my father and my grandmother. And that too is quite a fascinating thing for me. And we had a very fascinating conversation where he told me about his favorite book.
Which is?
Njengempela, which is written by D.P. Vilakazi. You know Vilakazi Street, that's very famous in Soweto, is actually named after that guy. He's a Zulu writer and philosopher.
And this was a set work that he had at school.
It's not a set work that he had at school. It's a book that he got to read, I think, eventually when he was on Robben Island over the years that he was there. And the book is based on a war primarily between what they call amakholwa, the like Christians, and amaqaba, the traditionalists. And it's around the fight for civilization. You know, it's about colonialism and its place in KwaZulu, but there's also a love story embedded in it. And it's amazing.
And he reads this every year.
And this is one of his favorite books that he visits quite often. And it was just, and for him to, you know, and what he then says, which is one of the things that also, you know, tickles the cockles of my Zulu heart, is when he says Nkosazana, you know, as Miss. So when he talks, when he was speaking to me, that was the story that he was telling. And I was just like so fascinated at the man who at the time was in the height of his vilification. And you know, as the thing that came through that says, but he can't read. And I'm going, but this man has a deep knowledge and a deep interest in knowledge and education and bettering himself. I wonder where this happened. I wonder at which point, because that's the thing that fascinates me, is at which point does one turn to be this monster?
Well, no one is, even the worst people in the world are not 100% monster. And that's what we fail to realize as humans. We always want to categorize someone as being bad or good.
Yes, we've got this very...
But there are good people...
Binary very, way of yeah, looking
binary,
at...
This binary take on things.
I mean...
I hear, by the way, that Zuma is a brilliant chess player.
Yes, he is. In fact, the foundation runs a chess tournament. Mm. But you know, chess, which was, again, something he learned on Robben Island, was one of the ways that, as they say, the system, it's one of the ways that... that the SB used to root out people that they believed were within the struggle because of the strategy behind playing the chess game. So if you were good at chess, you were often targeted.
Huh. Isn't that interesting? So let's hope he does write this book. I think it would be a valuable contribution. And of course, he hasn't got anything to lose, so why not?
I've got to say, though, you know, if I could just toss an aside in terms of, you know, the way in which people go about reading. You know, the ability to read in a language that is not your mother tongue, but, you know, to be able to read from a piece of paper and to be able to then articulate it, I think is actually really difficult if it's not your mother tongue.
Sure.
And the reason why I'm able to say this is because, you know, I do speak a couple of other languages. Let's take, you know, Italian, for example. I'm able to hold a very reasonable conversation in Italian, but if I have to actually read from a piece of paper, whereas in
hard.
If I'm reading in English, I read an entire paragraph at a time, which means that I'm able to actually, even before the words are escaping my lips, I'm in a position to frame the intonation that's going to go with it.
Mm-hmm.
But with the Italian or with French, I have to read literally one word at a time. And it's really difficult for you to frame the way in which you express an idea when you haven't grasped the entire idea in your head at the time.
When you're grappling with language as well as the idea.
Exactly. So I cut Jacob Zuma a lot of slack in terms of his ability to actually read out speeches. Put the guy off the cuff, you know, where he's got it in his head, and he's second to none, really.
You know, you say that about grappling with the idea as well as the language.
Mm.
In my view, it's one of the reasons why we're so poor. Our children are so poor at maths. And science is because for a lot of our kids in South Africa, they are busy dealing with a concept as well as trying to deal with the language of the concept.
That's a false correlation.
No, I don't think so.
The reason why it's false is because you don't need to learn maths in English.
Let me finish my thought process and then you can come in. So the thing is, when somebody is explaining to you something. And I've never quite understood it until a friend of mine explained to me his experience with this, where he was doing science second year science. And the teacher was explaining about radicals and how those chemicals, radicals, can be used as sieves to purify other chemicals. But he didn't know what a sieve was. He did not know what a sieve was. So he could, as he was trying to understand what does that mean, the class moves on. So he didn't know what a sieve was, and so the class moves on, and he's behind.
I'm with you on science, because there are a lot of things that are tied to language in science. And interesting that science has a language all of its own as well, because in things like chemistry, you use symbols. And the language of a chemical equation, for example, is understood to people in Russia, people in China, people in Afghanistan, and people in the United States of America. But with maths, I mean, I was basically illiterate in maths until I applied myself fully to it. And in the space of a year, went from being someone who was barely passing maths to loving it, just because I'd applied myself. And it wasn't to do with English.
But if you don't understand a word sum, if you don't understand a word sum, if you don't understand the words of a word sum, you'll never get it.
No, numbers.
Pumi,
now
you must actually just take a break for a while. I have sent you guys a piece to the WhatsApp group.
Yeah.
Okay. It's called Lockhart's Lament. It's in terms of the way in which mathematics gets taught. It's got nothing to do with language. Read it and have a follow-up discussion after you've read through this piece. It is a thing of beauty about how you go about teaching mathematics. Mathematics is all about logic. Mathematics is never about language.
Yeah, and I also feel like we've made language way too powerful. I mean, it's obviously the thing that helps us to communicate with each other and create great ideas.
It's what carries the logic.
Well, no, because logic exists whether language likes it or not.
Exactly.
How do you explain it?
Logic, well, logic is that 1 + 1 = 2. And that's indisputable. In language, you can make it sound like it could be 3 or 4. But it's only ever going to be 2 in logic. Logic can exist without language. Language cannot exist without logic.
Exactly.
But how do you explain it?
The one is a superset of the other, to use language to describe maths. Right? I mean, I love science and maths, and I wish more people excelled at it in this country, because we do have very good, inquisitive, curious minds that could be applied in the sciences and in maths to the country's great benefit. And I'm not saying that as some kind of patriot or nationalist. I'm saying for the individual themselves. We have a problem with how we teach maths and how we teach science, and you can see it because the marks are piss poor. Someone who does really, really well in almost every other subject, including languages, still does badly in maths and science in South Africa. We have the lowest levels of numeracy in the world. That's shocking.
So with the few minutes we have left, and
you want to wish Moosey a happy birthday?
No.
You're not going to sing for Moosey Maimane?
Oh, man. Shame. He's got enough people singing for him. But here's what I do want us to use the last minutes.
Yeah.
Is, Canthan.
Yes.
Tell us about your experience.
Yes, absolutely.
With starting a party and getting it off the ground, and the elections and everything else, and
what's it like to
Quo Vadis?
What's it like to have a real stake in the game?
To be actually holding a fork and knife with that stake.
Yes. I guess the thing that really blew my mind in the short space of time that we campaigned, because remember that the campaigning was only over a period of 57 days before the elections.
Yeah.
Okay. 57 days to rack up 16,000 votes, taking out the likes of Ahang, taking out the likes of Azapo. These are, established players who've been there for the longest possible time. But the sheer outpouring of love for this brand, because I think for the first time, we had a group of South Africans who were saying, people, let's stop focusing on everything that's been wrong with our society up until now. Let's start focusing on how we actually go forward and how do we actually build. And that actually struck a chord just across the board. So, you know, do I feel terrible about losing 200,000 rand? Yes, I do. But do I believe that it was worth it? Absolutely, I do. I think that the ZACP is something that's going to actually thrive.
You're not calling it quits. You guys are carrying on.
Well, you see, the interesting thing is that people have now, because of the way in which we actually structured the thing from the get-go, because this is actually true democracy, because people have the ability within the constraints of the principles, obviously, to set up their own branches. And we're not referring to them as branches. We refer to them as strategic business units.
Franchises.
Yeah, franchises. No, actually, that's a very good model to look at, because effectively they are franchises that, you know, you take responsibility for setting up branches in your own community. So it's not a top-down approach like the other political parties have, where, you know, you have the National Executive Committee deciding who your candidates are going to be, what your policy priorities are going to be. No, actually, the idea is that if you're in a local municipality, you determine what those policy priorities are going to be, because of the fact that your priorities are going to be different if you are in KZN or if you are in the Western. I mean, if you're in the Western Cape, you know, the water supply might be something that's a priority. If you're in KZN, it might be pollution in the beaches might be an issue that you might want to be tackling. And people are spontaneously setting up these structures. And again, really, all that we've been doing so far is to just provide the framework, provide the digital infrastructure. But this is growing into something that's, I think, actually going to make a significant difference, which is really what that was the idea to start
off
with.
All you wanted to achieve.
Yes.
So the time, you guys pulled the trigger quite late. Do you think if you'd given yourselves a little bit more time, you would have achieved what you wanted? You would have gotten your 10 seats?
In hindsight, all of us are wise. Of course, the interesting thing is that we can keep analyzing that and going back and forth. And yes, there are many things that we would do differently on the benefit of hindsight. But then again, no one has ever done anything like this before. So when you're doing something that's entirely new and you want to be disruptive, you don't use the conventional rule book.
There were some interesting comments in the aftermath of the election where people saw that you'd got 16,000 votes and took the opportunity to be very mean about it. Like, look, you lost, you capitalist swine.
Really?
Yeah. There were a couple of even journalists, people who call themselves journalists, who were mean about that. Did you take any of that to heart?
No, never. The whole thing is, you know, let the dogs bark.
Have you met Captain?
The caravan moves on. And the quality of people that came into, I mean, to this day, the Facebook group continues to grow. The Telegram group continues to grow. The following on Twitter continues to grow. And the sheer volume of particularly young people who said, if only we knew that you guys were out there, we would have registered to vote. Which again was something that we had not taken into account.
Because that was precisely the demographic that was missing from this election.
Exactly. And I think now with the scenario where people basically, they're able to set up their own structures.
Yeah.
And, you know, in keeping with the principles. And people actually get the principles. They get the idea of not needing to suck up to politically correct bullshit. And you know, what people don't understand is that being politically correct doesn't mean, saying no
doesn't
to...
Doesn't mean you're correct.
But also saying no to political correctness doesn't mean that you become rude. Because I think we need to recognize
absolutely
inherent goodwill that we have as South Africans. People do stupid shit. I mean, coming in this morning, when I was turning from Witkoppen onto Rivonia, and there's, you know, at the short left, there's a pedestrian crossing with a yield sign, and there are pedestrians waiting to cross. So I stop and let the pedestrians cross. And I have these angry people behind me honking and saying, why am I
stopping? Imagine, at 10 to 7, people are angry and honking.
Yeah.
Imagine being so cross at the start of your day.
At 10 to 7 in the morning.
And you know, but it's the law. Let the people
cross
the road.
Are not listening to this show.
All We'll give them plenty to get cross about.
I don't know how we got distracted out there.
But Gavin, so absolutely you would do it all over again. What was the best part of the experience for you?
That's a trick question.
It's not, man. It's a standard question. Up front. Straight line, Baba.
I don't know how. No, when you say the best part, I love
reformulate it slightly. Sure. It must have felt really good to put your money where your mouth was. Because a lot of people in this country talk, including Ace Magashule now. They talk and talk and talk. But when it comes to actually putting yourself to the test and saying, I'm going to throw caution to the wind, I'm going to attempt something that's never been attempted before, I'm going to try to build a base from zero, that must have felt gratifying.
The truly gratifying part, I think, if you want to conceptualize it that way, I always had a belief that there was a significant body of us as South Africans who are just amazing people. And I still believe that. You know, I think we are an utterly fabulous group of people in this country. That and, you know, I've said this in terms of racism. I said, you know, people keep, you know, going on about racism. Actually, we are one of the most racially sensitive group of people in the entire world because of our history.
You know that for a fact because every time that there is some incident of racism, it makes the news.
Yes.
Now, if racism were all over the place, that would not be the case.
But also, I travel widely, and you know, going around the world, I do know that on a day-to-day basis. If you want to actually summarize the way in which we engage with each other, just go to a shopping mall on payday, okay, well, towards the end of the month, and watch the people in the line for the ATM.
Total mix.
Yes, and watch the way in which they engage with each other.
Friendly.
Yeah, they're friendly, they're accommodating, and we're absolutely polite. You know, there's that discrete gap that you have between the person at the ATM and the people who are forming the line about 10 meters behind because you're giving the person space so that you're not, you know, crowding.
Looking over their shoulder.
Yeah, looking over their shoulder and all of that. We're a fantastic bunch of people. And the whole idea is that if you get people away from the divisive narrative and you can actually focus on the fact that we want to work together and we want to fix this country and make it a better place. And people kept saying, you know, no, actually, you know, whites are horrible, blacks are horrible, you know, Chinese are horrible. And they keep pointing fingers. And my point is, if we actually build something that's pulling us together, people will actually flock to it. And I think that for me, being proven right about that thing was the thing that's important. 16,000 people over the period of 57 days bought into that particular vision. You know, 5 years' time, let's see where it goes.
Good. It's not going away, though.
It's not going away. So I mean, it's out of our. I mean, yes, the 10 of us started it, and again, you know, the 10 bunch of people. Remember that most of us didn't know each other when we started, because the way in which this was not. Unlike the Freedom Front, which is basically a family business, you know, this was a question of actually going out to recruit like-minded people across the board, and to this day, you know, Gideon Joubert, who was one of the early people to come on board. We have not met in person. You know, we engage on a daily basis in terms of the WhatsApp group. We have video call discussions, but, you know, physically meeting and shaking hands. We've never met. But, you know, what pulls us together is ideas. And ultimately, that's the South African story, isn't it?
That's powerful stuff. I'm glad we ended on that because it leaves everybody on a bit of a high as opposed to starting with Ace Magashule. So Pumi, thank you. Canton, thank you. That is the Burning Platform today, brought to you by Nando's. I promised you something between spicy and extra hot. I think we might have got all of them.
This is CliffCentral.com.